Susan Yonke with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, Israelis go to the polls after a subdued election campaign. Iranian ammunition reported surfacing across African conflicts. Have political rights and civil liberties actually improved in Libya?
In Libya today, what you see are hundreds of civil society organizations, dozens of media outlets, and an elected representative, Congress.
And Syrians are ferrying goods from Iraq. It's all ahead. Israelis are going to the polls to elect a new parliament. Public opinion surveys indicate that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party and the nationalist Israel Our Home party should win enough seats to form the next government. But last-minute shifts in the electorate could bring surprises. VOA's Scott Bopp reports from Jerusalem.
Israelis Tuesday turned out in large numbers under sunny skies to choose their next Knesset, or parliament. Lilian Brunswick, who immigrated to Israel 50 years ago, said security was her primary concern.
I want our government to protect Israel.
Jack Jamal said most Israelis want peace with their Palestinian neighbors, but that is not likely to happen because of the stalled peace talks.
The main issues, I think, have been domestic in this particular election. They're talking about social issues, economic issues, equality of opportunities, equality of obligations, and these are the main issues.
Polls showed the center-right alliance of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu poised to win between one-fourth and one-third of the seats in the 120-seat legislature. This would represent a decline of support from the last elections 4 years ago, but would be enough to allow him to form the next government. Center-left parties, led by Likud's traditional rival Labor, were projected to make gains, as were parties on the far right. As a result, many analysts project that the negotiations to form the next Israeli government are likely to be difficult. Scott Bobb, VOA News, Jerusalem.
We asked Scott about the Israeli procedural system and if Netanyahu is being elected directly.
It's a proportional representation. The parties vote on and present their lists. He is at the top of the list of this alliance, and so he would be the prime minister as being the number one person on that list if his alliance is chosen, which, as I said, is likely. And then as many seats as they win, they go down that list. If they win 30, 32 seats, they'll go down to number 32, let's say, and those people will become members of the Knesset. It's not a direct election of individuals. It's a proportional election.
He says this time Israeli international relations is not at the forefront.
It's always in the background, but it hasn't been a major campaign issue. But people are worried about security. That's something that comes up a great deal when I speak to some of the voters. And, of course, when they say security, the Israelis mean that they want a tough defense. They want to feel secure in their country. For the Arabs, and the turnout among Arab Israelis is much lower. It's quite a bit of despair, a lack of hope. They don't see much future, even though their leaders and even Israeli leaders across the spectrum have called them to vote and to participate.
Jerusalem correspondent Scott Bobb. Years, unmarked ammunition has been circulating in some of Africa's bloodiest conflict zones, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Ivory Coast. After a six-year investigation, arms investigators say they have figured out where the ammunition is being made. Iran. Sayla Hennessy has details from London.
A new report published this month says Iranian ammunition is circulating widely in Africa despite a United Nations arms embargo on Iran. A breakthrough for the arms investigators came in 2010. At Apapa Wharf in Lagos, Nigeria, security forces intercepted 13 containers holding more than 240 metric tons of ammunition. Later, the offloading bill showed the containers had been sent from Iran, labeled as building materials. The cartridges were identical to those that had already been sighted across Africa, first in northern Kenya in 2006. But arms investigator James Bevan says the cartridges were unmarked.
A manufacturer will put on the end of its cartridges its own manufacturer's code. So that identifies the manufacturer of origin and by extension the country in which it was produced. That's not the case for this ammunition. All it has is a caliber designation and a year of manufacture.
Bevan says evidence suggests government forces have used the ammunition in Sudan, Guinea, Ivory Coast, and Kenya.
The African governments procure the ammunition from Iran for use by their own defense and security forces. This ammunition is then used by those forces, and then at some point further down the line, the ammunition is transferred whether to insurgent groups in neighboring countries or rebel forces. That's a general pattern.
Rebel groups have used the ammunition, Bevan says, in major conflict zones, including the Democratic Republic of Congo, where millions have died in more than two decades of bloodshed. Tehran has not responded to the report, and the researchers say they don't know who within Iran is responsible for the transfers. A United Nations arms trade treaty that would monitor the international sale of arms has yet to be finalized. International aid agency Oxfam wants ammunition monitoring to be part of the treaty, despite opposition from a number of countries, including the United States. Oxfam says 12 billion bullets are produced every year, an industry worth over $4 billion. New rules are needed, it says, to make sure ammunition is secure and its transfer is regulated. Martin Butcher is an arms advisor at Oxfam.
The single greatest factor in reducing civilian casualties in particular and for damping down conflict is to cut off the supply of ammunition. So there are governments and armed groups across sub-Saharan Africa who are looking for ammunition, and ammunition has become much traded on the grey market and on the illicit market in order to keep these conflicts going.
International troops are right now battling Islamist militants in Mali. In neighboring Niger, Islamists have been reported to use Iranian ammunition. Researcher Bevan says in time his team will be heading to Mali to find out if Iranian ammunition has made its way to yet another African conflict zone. Saleh Hennessy for VOA News, London.
A new report by the pro-democracy watchdog group Freedom House says political rights and civil liberties have improved in Libya. The annual report, issued in Washington, says that despite the September 11, 2012 attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya actually gained its freedom rankings over the past year. Alaa Abuzakuk is a senior program associate with the Middle East North African programs at Freedom House. We asked about the situation in Libya.
Libya, before 2012, was ranked among the world's worst tyrannies for decades. Of course, since the liberation of the country in October 23rd, 2011, I think we've seen significant citizen participation and willingness to participate in the political direction of the country. In Libya today, what you see are hundreds of civil society organizations, dozens of media outlets, and an elected representative Congress that essentially showcases figures from around the country, from the geographical spectrum, the ideological spectrum, ethnic spectrum. And so, it's a marked difference from Gaddafi's totalitarian rule. And there's much more dynamism that has taken place in the country. And in the case of Libya, where, the power was defined by one man, now it is being defined by many actors.
So you're optimistic that this might last, it might continue?
I am cautiously optimistic in the case of Libya, because with Libya, there weren't any institutions, and they were already at the bottom. So there's nowhere else to go except for up. And I think 2013 will be an interesting year to see whether or not they will be able to ensure security and safety, establish the rule of law, enforce the rule of law. There are challenges, but the transition is dynamic. And I think when we are sitting in Washington, D.C., and we're reading all these security alerts that are taking place, I'm in constant interaction with civil society actors. And they're not cowering in their homes. They are participating, and they are trying to do the best that they can do to define this new chapter and new phase in their country's political history.
Alaa Abuzakuk, a senior program associate with the Middle East North Africa programs at Freedom House. wave of car bombings in and around the Iraqi capital has killed at least 16 people. The blast today included an attack near an army base in Taji, 25 kilometers north of Baghdad, which killed 6 people and wounded at least 20 others. Another car bomb killed 5 people, including 2 soldiers, near a security checkpoint in Mahmoudia, south of the capital. A third attack hit Baghdad's Shula neighborhood, killing 5 others. Last week, a string of attacks across the country killed at least 59 people. The ongoing conflict in Syria has led to chronic fuel and food shortages. As a result, thousands of desperate Syrians are carrying goods across an unofficial border crossing opened by the semi-autonomous Kurdish government in northern Iraq. Sebastian Meyer reports from the Iraq-Syria border.
Syrian men, bent double under the weight of their sacks, begin the 4-hour trek from Iraqi Kurdistan back to Syria. Every day, more than 3,000 men make this journey into northern Iraq to get essentials such as food and gasoline for their families back home. 22-year-old Ali Mohammed Badawi made a trip from Aleppo for macaroni and diapers. The journey took 14 hours.
There's no bread. There's no food. There's no gas. No fuel. People are starving.
Only a very few see this as a business opportunity. A liter of gasoline purchased in Iraq for $1 will sell in Syria for a mere 50 cents markup.
We don't sell the kerosene because we need it at home. We only sell the gasoline.
The unofficial crossing has been opened by the semi-autonomous Kurdish government in northern Iraq without the permission of the central government in Baghdad. Kurdish officials say their own history of suffering gives them responsibility to help Syrian Kurds.
The Kurds of Iraq have took lessons and have gone through those stages of history. And I think both the public itself and the administration itself in KRG feel that it is a responsibility to act and to support and to provide assistance because we went through and we know how tough and how difficult it is.
As the sun begins to set, a few remaining stragglers rush to leave Iraq. And with the conflict in Syria showing little signs of ending, cross-border traffic is unlikely to ease. Sebastian Meyer for VOA News, Şilike, Iraq.
U.S. President Barack Obama is beginning his second term in the White House. VOA's Paul Westphaling spoke with VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshra about the foreign policy challenges he faces.
Well, the first thing he has to do is continue his policy in Afghanistan. In other words, that has become his war. And so there, as you know, all American troops must be out by the end of 2014. But there are all sorts of issues that still need to be resolved between now and then. One of them is, what kind of residual force will the United States have in Afghanistan? And apparently, some of his military advisors are preparing plans, suggestions, as to how many troops should be there. And I've heard everything from 20,000 American troops to about 3,000, or even what is known as the zero option, nobody. Mm-hmm. That's a key factor. Mm-hmm. They also have to deal with corruption, because one of the main demands by the West and by the Americans was for Karzai's government and corruption. The key thing is this residual force, mm-hmm. because one has to remember that right now, according to American officials, al-Qaeda is on the run, so to speak, in Afghanistan. The Taliban are stopped, but if the Americans and the and NATO forces leave, what will prevent the Taliban from coming back in the southern and eastern region?
I guess the lesson that can be learned from all of this is what happened when the Russians pulled out.
Well, that's right. We are there, Paul. We are there longer than the Russians have been. Mm-hmm. The Russians have been there for almost 10 years, nine years and plus. They couldn't defeat them, so they just basically decided, okay, we're leaving.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's look to another area of mm-hmm. the world that seems to be perennially on anybody's news page. That's the Middle East. You've got Syria, you've got Iran, you've got the spillover into Iraq, Jordan, Turkey. Then you've got elections in Israel, Then you've got the Arab Spring. I mean, the list could go on.
That's
and on.
Right. The Middle East could go on and on. And one has to remember, Paul, that during President Obama's first administration, he was inaugurated in January. In February, he named Senator Mitchell as his special envoy to the Middle East. Mm-hmm. That's one of his first foreign policy decisions. 2 years later, Mitchell says, washing his hands, says, I can't resolve the Palestinian issue. Mm-hmm. So that is a void. But the United States must play a role. And as you say, elections in Israel, that'll be essential. There's this whole issue of who are the Palestinians? Because you have Mahmoud Abbas on one side, Hamas on the other, considered to be a terrorist organization. Mm-hmm. All experts say you got to talk to both of these groups. The United States doesn't want to talk to Hamas. So it's really will be a... As is it is with every American administration, the whole Middle East peace process, quote unquote. Syria, mm-hmm. You mentioned Syria. This is where you have a major disagreement between Russia and the United States. Mm-hmm. The United States wants Bashar al-Assad out. The Russians are saying no, we don't want a regime change. But they're slowly but surely changing their position. So that'll be something key to look forward in the next couple of months.
Iran.
That Iran,
still
of course,
continues to be a wild card.
It still is. As a matter of fact, a member of the International Atomic Energy Agency just ended a meeting with Iranian officials. No movement on that. No movement whatsoever. So in the meantime, they're continuing to build centrifuges, doing all of that. That's going to be a key issue. But the economic sanctions are biting now in Iran. And so that may be one way of trying to bring about some negotiations. But right now, who knows?
VOA senior correspondent Andre Dineshner here in our Washington studios. The president and first lady capped off Inauguration Day at two inaugural balls. The events were filled with dancing and listening to great performances from some of the nation's biggest stars. VOA's Carla Babb was there and stopped by the studio earlier today. So, Carla, late night last night, huh? What were the highlights?
Yes, it was a magnificent, wonderful night last night. I'd say the highlight for me personally was First Lady Michelle Obama and President Barack Obama's dance. They danced to the song Let's Stay Together. Jennifer Hudson came out. She was beautiful, by the way. She looked great, sounded great, and Michelle Obama's Jason Wu red dress was such a big hit. Everybody around me just said she looked spectacular.
It was gorgeous. I saw it on TV.
Yes.
So what were some of your other favorite moments?
For me, Usher's performance, there were several big stars there, and they all did wonderful jobs. But Usher's performance was the very end of the night, and I thought he was phenomenal. The place was absolutely huge, and he had a light display on the screen that covered the entire stage area. He sang, he danced, he sang the song OMG, which is one of his big hits, and when he started singing that, everybody went crazy.
And I hear you met a celebrity.
I did. I was just walking in the hallway, and who comes by but Katy Perry, and she was very sweet. She stopped and took a picture with us, said she was having a great time and loved Washington. It was really nice.
Well, you mentioned Mrs. Obama's dress, the beautiful red dress. What did you
yes.
wear?
Oh, me. What did I wear? I wore an electric blue, full-length, strapless evening gown. It had ruffles from the waist down. I really felt like a princess. It was a magical night, and I enjoyed every second of it in that dress.
What do you do most of the time at those events? Do you stand around and talk or drink or eat or what's going on?
Well, there's a lot of mingling, and you're just going and talking to your friends and meeting new people, and then you pause and watch the show. I mean, you have the dance by the president. You have the dance by the vice president and his wife as well, and then they just have so many amazing people. Alicia Keys was also there, and she did a great performance. And so it's just constant entertainment and constant fun.
And what time did you get to bed, I should say, this morning?
I will just say that I got to bed this morning in the wee hours, and then I came back to VOA this morning in the wee hours. So it was a fun night.
Well, at least you're honest about it.
Yes.
Thank you, Carla.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.